Welcome back to History's Burn Book, the podcast where we crack open history's yearbook, circle that drama in red pen, and remind historical figures that if they didn't want to be roasted, they should have made better choices. Today's entry comes from 18th century Britain and its increasingly irritated American colonies. Now, depending on how your history teacher approached this subject, you may have learned one of two versions of the American Revolution. So version one, colonies wanted freedom, Britain was mean, America won, the end. Or version two, taxes happened, tea happened, George Washington happened, America happened, and also the end. Neither version is really technically wrong. They're just missing enough details to derive a T-ship through. And the real story is a decades-long family feud that spiraled completely out of control. Nobody listened, everybody overreacted, and eventually, somebody started a war, as we tend to do. So let's begin with the biggest, most expensive breakup ever. To understand the American Revolution, we first need to discuss something people hate almost as much as today as they did in the 1760s, taxes. But before taxes came war, the French and Indian War began in 1754. Now, despite the name, it wasn't a war between France and indigenous tribes. It was primarily Britain and France fighting over territories in North America, while many native nations were forced to choose sides based on their own interests and survival. That fighting lasted almost a decade. Young George Washington even got his first taste of military action during that conflict. And let's just say his early military career was a work in progress. The future father of the country once accidentally helped trigger an international incident. Not exactly the beginning they put on monuments. But anyway, by 1763, Britain emerged victorious. The British Empire had gained enormous amounts of territory. Canada, land west of the Appalachian Mountains, prestige, power, a lot of bragging rights. There was just one problem. With victory came a massive bill. Britain's national debt had nearly doubled. Parliament looked at the numbers and collectively developed a stress headache. And someone needed to help pay for the war. Their eyes drifted towards the colonies, and the colonists were less enthusiastic about this idea. But King George III, who, by the way, went mad in his life, so he was kind of crazy, had basically said that the logic was simple, that the British soldiers had fought and British taxpayers had sacrificed, and the colonists benefited from the victory, therefore the colonies should contribute. Reasonable, right? The colonists had their own response. We never elected any of you in Parliament and have no representation, which is also reasonable. The disagreement would become the foundation of everything that followed. But before Parliament started taxing, they made another decision that made colonists furious. The Proclamation of 1763. This law prohibited settlement west of the Appalachian Mountains. Britain hoped it would reduce conflict between settlers and native nations. From London's perspective, it made sense. But fewer frontier wars meant lower military costs. So from the colonists' perspective, it was infuriating. Many colonists had fought, expecting access to Western lands afterwards. Land speculation companies had already invested heavily. Veterans expected opportunities. Instead, Parliament essentially said, "Congratulations on the victory. Please don't use it." Yeah. So the resentment began building. Then Parliament grabbed a shovel and kept digging. Enter the Sugar Act, the Currency Act, the Stamp Act. The Stamp Act was the one that literally detonated public anger. Passed in 1765, it required tax stamps on newspapers, legal documents, licenses, pamphlets, contracts, playing cards, and various printed materials. If you wanted to do business, publish your ideas, buy property, or basically function as a literate adult, Parliament wanted a cut. The reaction was immediate and loud. Printers erupted, lawyers, merchants, ordinary colonists, they all erupted. It was an equal opportunity outrage machine. Across the colonies, protests spread rapidly. Crowds gathered. Tax collectors were threatened. Effigies burned in the streets. People discovering that settling symbolic representations of government officials on fire was strategically therapeutic. One of the loudest voices belonged to Patrick Henry. He was a young Virginia legislator who delivered speeches so fiery that they made other politicians visibly uncomfortable. Henry argued that Virginians possessed the same rights as citizens living in Britain, which Parliament disagreed with that. And thus began America's long-running political tradition, people yelling at each other about constitutional rights. Meanwhile, a new organization emerged, the Sons of Liberty. Now, depending on who was describing them, they were either brave defenders of liberty or an organized mob with excellent branding. The truth is somewhere in the middle of that. That group included Samuel Adams, John Hancock, Paul Revere, and numerous merchants, craftsmen, sailors, and laborers. One of my favorite people, Hercules Mulligan, was in that group. He is a great man. I'm going to have to do a whole episode on Hercules because he and his dear servant Cato did a lot of work. Anyway, they organized protests, boycotts, demonstrations, public pressure campaigns, and occasionally activities that would make modern attorneys advise complete silence. Tax collectors became targets. One collector, his name was Andrew Oliver, found an effigy of himself hanging from a tree. Another official had his home attacked. The message was clear, though. Collect taxes if you want, just don't expect anyone to make it pleasant. Parliament eventually repealed the Stamp Act, and the colonies celebrated. You know, church bells rang, public parties erupted, people congratulated themselves. But unfortunately, Parliament learned exactly the wrong lesson. Instead of realizing the representation issue mattered, many leaders assumed colonists simply disliked that particular tax. So they tried again, because apparently nobody had learned anything. So, the Townshend Acts arrived in 1767. New taxes on imported glass, lead, paint, paper, and most importantly, tea. The colonists responded with widespread boycotts. Women played a surprisingly big, important role here, but of course you don't hear about that much. Groups known as the Daughters of Liberty encouraged households to avoid British goods. Homemade fabrics became symbols of resistance. Political activism wasn't limited to the men making speeches. Women were actually organizing entire economic campaigns from their homes. Britain continued missing the point. The taxes weren't huge. The principle was. Every tax reinforced the same message. You will follow laws created by people you did not elect. And colonists increasingly hated that message. So we leave off where Britain and the colonies are trapped in a relationship that had become increasingly toxic, obviously. Parliament kept pressing those taxes and colonies kept protesting and everyone insisted they were being perfectly reasonable, but nobody was being perfectly reasonable. And then Boston entered the chat. Now, if the American Revolution had a main character city, it would be Boston. Philadelphia would eventually write the important documents. New York would become the financial powerhouse. But Boston is where people went when they wanted to start trouble. Okay, that city was crowded, busy, politically alive, and absolutely overflowing with people who believed Britain had lost its mind, which, I mean, fair, because it's King George III. Woohoo! Anyway, so by 1768, British officials had become so concerned about unrest that they stationed troops in the city. This was not received well. Imagine already being annoyed with your government and then watching soldiers march through your streets every day. If you know, I live in Minnesota, so yeah, that happened. Anyway, the British viewed the troops as a way to maintain order. colonists viewed them as an occupying force. Nobody felt reassured. Tensions simmered constantly. Soldiers competed with locals for jobs. And arguments broke out in taverns. Street fights became common. Insults flew daily. The atmosphere was so tense that a strong breeze could have started a riot. Now, then came March 5th of 1770. And history would never stop arguing about what happened next, because the trouble began with a young apprentice named Edward Garrick. Garrick accused a British officer of failing to pay a bill. The British sentry named Private Hugh White took offense. Now, the words were exchanged. More people gathered, and even more people gathered. And because if humans have remained consistent throughout history, it's that we absolutely cannot resist watching other people's arguments. The crowd grew. Snowballs started flying. Some people reported reportedly those snowballs had rocks inside. Others contained chunks of ice. The soldiers were insulted, shoved, and pelted. Reinforcements arrived under Captain Thomas Preston, and the situation became increasingly chaotic. Then shots ran out. When the smoke cleared, five colonists lay dead or dying. One of them was a man named Crispus Atticus. Now let's pause here, okay? Crispus deserves more attention than he often receives in school textbooks. He was a sailor and dock worker of African and Native American ancestry. He became the first person killed during what many considered the opening chapter of the Revolution. His death transformed him into one of the earliest martyrs of the Patriot cause. The event came known as the Boston Massacre. And Samuel Adams immediately recognized a public relations opportunity. History sometimes paints Adams as a lovable revolutionary kind of grandfather, but in reality, he understood political messaging with the efficiency of a modern campaign strategist. Within days, the Patriot leaders began shaping that narrative. No one was more effective than Paul Revere. Yes, the Midnight Ride guy, the silversmith, the folk hero. The man who apparently refused to have only one historical achievement. Because Revere produced an engraving depicting British soldiers firing an organized formation into a peaceful crowd. The image spread throughout the colonies, but there was just one problem. It wasn't exactly accurate. Yeah, the crowd hadn't been standing peacefully. The confrontation had been messy, chaotic, and dangerous. But the accuracy wasn't the goal. The influence was. And that influence worked. The image transformed public opinion, and the Boston Massacre became a symbol. The British soldiers eventually went on trial. Ironically, their defense attorney was future Patriot leader John Adams. Yeah. Adams believed everyone deserved a fair trial. Despite public outrage, most of the soldiers were acquitted. Two were convicted of manslaughter. John Adams later called this defense of one of the most courageous actions. It was one of the most courageous actions of his career. Now, imagine defending the people your future revolution wants to blame for everything. That takes nerve or incredible stubbornness. Maybe a little bit of both. But for a short time, tensions eased. But Parliament remained determined to assert authority. And then came the tea. Of all the things that launched a revolution, tea remains one of the most funniest choices. Not because tea was unimportant. Tea was everywhere. People drank it constantly. Tea was essentially the coffee of the 18th century, and I prefer tea over coffee myself, so I get it. If your government started messing with coffee today, people would probably lose their minds. I will say that. But in 1773, Parliament passed the Tea Act. Now, this is where things get real interesting. The Tea Act actually lowered the cost of tea. Yes, they lowered it. Many people hear Tea Act and assume Britain raised the taxes, but that's not exactly what happened. The law gave the British East India Company special privileges that allowed it to sell tea directly to the colonies at lower prices. The company was actually struggling financially at the time, and Parliament wanted to save it. So the East India Company was basically the Amazon, Apple, and private army rolled into one giant corporation at this time. And Parliament was trying to bail it out. But the colonists saw something deeper. If they accepted the tea, they were accepting Parliament's right to tax them. So suddenly, cheap tea wasn't a bargain. It was a trap. Ships carrying East India Company tea arrived in colonial ports. Many colonists sent them away, but Boston, old Boston, gave them an exception. Because of course they did. Now, Governor Thomas Hutchinson refused to allow the ships to leave. The tea remained stuck in Boston Harbor. And for weeks, tensions escalated. Meetings grew larger. Crowds grew angrier. And nobody seemed interested in compromise. So on December 16th of 1773, thousands gathered at the Old South Meeting House. The debate continued for hours. Then word arrived that Governor Hutchinson would not back down. Samuel Adams reportedly declared, "This meeting can do nothing further to save the country." Whether he intended it as a signal remains debated. But moments later, events exploded. A group of men headed towards Griffin's Wharf. Many wore crude disguises resembling those Mohawk warriors. And disguises served multiple purposes. Some wanted anonymity. I can never say that word. Others wished to symbolize an American identity separate from Britain. Whatever the reason, they boarded three ships: the Dartmouth, the Eleanor, and the Beaver. And they got to work. For nearly 3 hours, they systematically smashed open tea chests and dumped their contents into Boston Harbor. 342 chests. 4,500. Why did I say 100? Because I was thinking 100. 45 tons of tea. Thousands upon thousands of pounds into Boston Harbor. Modern estimates place the value in the millions of dollars in tea. Remarkably, little else was damaged. The participants were surprisingly disciplined. One man reportedly stole tea and was publicly reprimanded for it. Imagine participating in one of the most famous acts of political protest in history and getting in trouble for shoplifting. Kind of funny. The harbor became a giant cup of unwanted British tea. And the Boston Tea Party instantly became legendary. Britain, of course, was not amused by it. In London, Parliament reacted with fury. Many British officials believed the colonies had crossed a line. Protests were one thing, but destroying private property was very much another. Parliament responded with a series of laws known in Britain as the Coercive Acts. Americans gave it a different name, the Intolerable Acts. Honestly, that branding battle wasn't even close. Now, the Intolerable Acts closed Boston Harbor. It restricted local government, expanded British authority, and allowed troops to be housed more easily. The goal was simple: punish Massachusetts, make an example out of Boston, scare everyone else into obedience. Instead, Britain accidentally united the colonies. Again! It's almost impressive how often British policymakers managed to achieve the exact opposite of what their intended outcome was. Food and supplies poured into Boston from other colonies. Sympathy spread, resistance expanded, and the colonies increasingly viewed themselves as partners in a common struggle. In September of 1774, delegates actually gathered in Philadelphia for the first Continental Congress. Representatives from 12 colonies attended. Georgia sat this one out, but delegates debated their options. Some still hoped reconciliation was possible. Others believed conflict was inevitable. And no one knew yet how far events would go. Meanwhile, a political pamphlet was preparing to change everything. And soon a man named Thomas Paine would pour gasoline on an already raging fire. But before Paine's pen could ignite the colonies, another event would push them toward war. In Massachusetts, both sides were preparing. British General Thomas Gage received orders to suppress resistance. Patriot militias stockpiled weapons. Rumors spread constantly. Everyone expected trouble, and nobody knew exactly when it would arrive. That date turned out to be April 18th of 1775. And history is about to hear one of the most famous midnight rides. So, Britain is punishing Boston for the Tea Party. Colonies are beginning to reunite against Parliament, and Massachusetts just became a giant political pressure cooker with the lid rattling dangerously. And nobody trusted anybody. Everyone was stockpiling weapons, rumors spread faster than facts, and both sides insisted they wanted peace while prepping for war. History has seen this movie before, and it never ends well. By early 1775, General Thomas Gage, and he, at this time, they made him Britain's military governor of Massachusetts, he had a little problem. Actually, kind of several problems, because the colonists were openly organizing militias. Weapons were being hidden throughout the countryside. Patriot leaders like Samuel Adams and John Hancock continued encouraging resistance. Every attempt to restore order seemed to create more disorder. London wanted results. Gage needed action. British intelligence informed him that colonial militias had gathered military supplies in the town of Concord, about 20 miles northwest of Boston. Cannons, gunpowder, weapons, equipment. The solution seemed simple. Send your soldiers, confiscate the supplies, arrest key Patriot leaders if possible, go home easy, right? The British had roughly 700 trained professional soldiers. The colonists were farmers, blacksmiths, laborers, merchants, shopkeepers. What could possibly go wrong, right? Well, everything. Because Patriots had developed something surprisingly effective. A communications network. Oh, right? Long before text messages, social media, and neighborhood Facebook groups where people argue about garbage cans, the colonists had built an impressive intelligence system. Messages traveled consistently. Information spread through taverns, churches, businesses, private homes. Everyone seemed to know everybody's business. And when British troops started moving, word spread quickly. The evening of April 18th of 1775, General Gage ordered his troops across Boston Harbor. Their mission was to march into Concord, destroy military supplies, capture Patriot leaders if possible. But unfortunately for Gage, Patriot spies were already watching. One of those Patriots was Dr. Joseph Warren. Warren learned of the British plan and immediately sent riders into the countryside. One of those writers would become a legend. His name was Paul Revere. Now let's address something, okay? Paul Revere did not ride through Massachusetts screaming, "The British are coming." That makes great for elementary school story, but it isn't true. Most colonists still consider themselves British at this time. So yelling, "The British are coming," would have been about as useful as standing in Minnesota and shouting, "The Americans are coming," because, yeah. People would simply just stare at you. Instead, Revere's mission was more specific. Warn Patriot leaders, alert the militias, spread the alarm. And he wasn't alone. William Dawes also rode that night. A third rider, Samuel Prescott, joined them later on. For some reason, history gave most of the credit to Revere, probably because his name sounds cooler in poetry. Thanks to Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Paul Revere became a household name. William Dawes became an answer to a trivia question, and by midnight, the countryside buzzed with warnings. Church bells rang, signal guns fired, messengers spread out in every direction, militia companies began assembling, and the British were marching straight into a trap they didn't even know existed. At dawn on April 19th, British troops reached Lexington. Waiting for them on the town green stood approximately 70 colonial militiamen. These weren't hardened soldiers at all. They were ordinary citizens. The farmers, tradesmen, neighbors, men who had spent years hearing arguments about liberty and rights, and now they found themselves standing face to face with one of the most powerful armies in the world. Neither side wanted a fire first. At least not officially. British Major John Pitcairn, cannot pronounce anything today, ordered the militia to disperse. Now, someone shouted, someone moved, and the gunshot rang out. To this day, nobody knows who fired it. Seriously. One of the most important shots in the world in history remains unsolved. Was it a nervous militiaman? A British soldier? Accidental discharge? Somebody hiding nearby? Who knows? It is history's ultimate cold case, I swear. And what happened next is even clearer. British soldiers opened fire. The militia scattered. 8 Americans were killed. 10 more were wounded. The British continued toward Concord. And the revolution crossed a line from protest into bloodshed. Ralph Waldo Emerson would later describe that first shot as the shot heard round the world. Not because everyone literally heard it, because its consequences echoed across continents. At Concord, things became worse. British soldiers searched for military supplies, but the Patriots had already hidden most of it. The mission was producing disappointing results. Meanwhile, hundreds of militia members gathered outside town. As tensions mounted, fighting erupted at Northbridge. At this time, though, colonial forces returned fire. British soldiers suffered casualties. The regulars suddenly realized something alarming. The colonists were fighting back. The British began their march towards Boston, and that's when the day became a nightmare. Military forces swarmed from every direction. Farmers hid behind trees and fired. They would hide behind stone walls, fields, buildings. Each militia unit arrived militia units were just flying in. The British endured a running battle for nearly 20 miles, and by the time they reached Boston, more than 250 soldiers had been killed, wounded, or captured. Colonial losses were significant, but much lower. The message was unmistakable. The war had begun. So news spread through the colonies with astonishing speed. Within days, thousands of militia members surrounded Boston. The siege of Boston was underway. The city effectively became trapped. British forces occupied Boston. Patriot militias occupied everything around it. Imagine being locked inside the world's most awkward neighborhood dispute, because that would be weird. Now multiply it by muskets, right? Meanwhile, the Congressional Congress gathered in Philadelphia. Delegates faced a difficult question. What exactly happens after you've accidentally started a war with Britain? Some still hoped reconciliation was possible. Others believed independence was now inevitable. And one thing became increasingly clear. If the colonies were going to fight, they needed leadership. And that leadership would come from Virginia. Enter George Washington. Now, Washington arrived at the Continental Congress wearing his military uniform. Subtle, he was not. At 6'2", he towered over many of his comrades. He possessed military experience, political credibility, and perhaps the most importantly, he was from Virginia. Choosing a Virginian to help unite northern and southern colonies behind a common cause. Now, on June 15th of 1775, George Washington became commander of the Continental Army. He accepted the position with visible anxiety, which honestly was probably the healthiest response available at the time, because the army he inherited was a disaster. It was a collection of militias, minimal training, limited supplies, little organization, no guarantee of success. But what Washington received was less of an army and more of a collection of enthusiastic volunteers just carrying weapons. Now, his first challenge arrived almost immediately. Just outside Boston stood two strategic hills, Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill. The colonists occupied them. British decided to remove them. And on June 17th of 1775, one of the bloodiest battles of the early war erupted, the Battle of Bunker Hill. Now, tragically, most of the fighting occurred, well, technically, I should say, most of the fighting occurred on Breed's Hill. History ignored this distraction because apparently the Battle of Breed's Hill lacked marketing appeal. So British forces attacked repeatedly, again and again and again, and colonial defenders held their ground until ammunition ran low. Eventually, they had to retreat. The British won the battlefield, but the victory came at a horrifying cost. More than 100 British casualties. And the colonists learned something important. They could stand against professional soldiers. The British learned something important too, that winning this war would be far more difficult than expected. As the smoke drifted over the battlefield, both sides faced a very uncomfortable reality. The conflict was no longer about taxes or tea or parliamentary authority. Men had died. Armies were forming. And colonies and Britain were sliding toward war neither side really fully understood. And then, when tensions couldn't possibly escalate further, a recent immigrant from England picked up a pen. And his name was Thomas Paine. His pamphlet, called Common Sense, would transform a colonial rebellion into a revolutionary movement. But that's a story for the next episode, because in episode 2, we're going to follow George Washington into a chaos of war. We'll meet spies, traitors, heroes, foreign allies, and one named Benedict Arnold, who somehow turned his name into a synonym for betrayal. And trust me, that takes effort. So until next time, remember, history isn't written by the winners. It's written by the survivors. And sometimes by the people with the best printing presses. Thank you very much, and next episode will be out soon.